Kia ora and welcome to the Female Career Podcast. My name is Anna Johnston and our podcast shares the twists and turns of the career journeys of a wide range of women of Aotearoa. We hope that by listening to these stories that you'll feel inspired in your own career. Now today's episode is one of a special five-part mini-series that we're really proud to have developed in collaboration with Te Tauraua Tūhono, New Zealand Trade and Enterprise. NZTE helps grow Kiwi companies internationally, bigger, better and faster, for the good of Aotearoa and the world. Each of these five podcast episodes brings you an inspiring story of women who've taken their Kiwi companies to the global stage. A big thank you to NZTE for their support to bring these stories to life. And if you'd like to find out more about NZTE and how they might help you grow your business, search online for NZTE Women in Export. We really hope you enjoy listening, and if you'd be interested in any leadership or career coaching to support your own career journey, drop us a line, hello@thefemalecareer.com. I'm really looking forward to speaking with Janine Granger. Janine is the co-founder and CEO of Easy Crypto, New Zealand's leading cryptocurrency trading platform. Easy Crypto now has over 150,000 customers across New Zealand, Australia, South Africa and Brazil, and has recorded well over $1 billion in sales through the platform over the past 3 years. Janine herself has been involved in cryptocurrency since 2015 and is one of New Zealand's most visible voices in the sector. Prior to Easy Crypto, Janine worked in senior operational and people leadership positions at Air New Zealand and Westpac, and also in consulting with PwC. And I look forward to hearing more about Janine, her career journey, and also her experiences of going global today. Kia ora, Janine, and thank you very much for joining me.
Kia ora, Anna. Thanks for having me on.
Wonderful. Well, the first question that I'd love to ask you, and it's one that we ask all our guests, takes you a little way back, but I'd love to hear more. Tell me a bit more about the first few years of your career. You know, what were some of the highlights and challenges of that period?
Yeah, well, I possibly had a bit of an unconventional start in that I'm actually a high school dropout. So my career started waitressing and making coffees in a local cafe. And then from there, I sort of had a few different twists and turns, including doing an OE, a bit of overseas travel. And I ended up coming back to university in my 20s because it sort of took me that long to decide what it was that I wanted to do. And I think it was actually useful to get sort of, you know, some experience and some work behind me before I went back into university. So after uni, where I majored in economics and finance and a commerce degree, I went into local government and also did a few years in PwC working in management consulting before heading into the strategy roles at Westpac and Air New Zealand that you mentioned. There's been a lot of different sort of interesting things that I've done across the time, particularly working at PwC. I think that was one of my favourite jobs because it just exposed me to so many different companies, so many different roles and operations. And, you know, I really learned a lot in that career. But everything I've done has been really interesting and sort of has built up this mesh of odd skills that ended up all being quite helpful to get me where I am today.
I like the way you talk about it as a mesh of odd skills. But that's often the way, isn't it? Your career, each experience builds on the next and suddenly you end up where you are and realise, oh my goodness, I've got all of these things and suddenly I'm using a skill that maybe I hadn't touched for 20 years, but it was there all the time.
100%. And that's often one of the things that I sort of, you know, if people ask my advice on how to, you know, progress in your career. And I mean, I don't know if it's advice so much as just my experience, but my experience was that I just constantly went after things that I found interesting and where I thought I could learn something that I enjoyed. And once you sort of build all those skills together, you know, before you know it, you've got the makings of something that you never thought you might have worked your way into, like being the CEO of a crypto business.
There you go. And also thank you for sharing the piece about school and leaving school early, because sometimes people think there's, you know, certain ways maybe to get ahead in life or in your career, but school's not for everyone. And as you said, even that learning experience, first few years working, then going to university, actually was hugely valuable to then, I'm sure, like really make the most of uni from a practical standpoint too.
Absolutely.
And then tell me a little bit more about the idea of, I mean, how did you even get into cryptocurrency? How did the whole idea come about?
So I think, as you mentioned in the intro, I first got into cryptocurrency, I think 2015, and I just came across it on the internet, as you do, in a forum somewhere. And I remember thinking how much sense this thing made. So it was Bitcoin at that stage, I think, was the only crypto, or at least the only one I came across. And it made a lot of sense that, you know, with the internet, we have this global village, people can engage and transact and share information globally, but we didn't have a way to share value or make payments globally. So I bought a few Bitcoin, not enough to make myself a billionaire, but just, or even a millionaire, but just enough to, you know, learn how the system worked. And then nothing really happened for a couple of years. And I sort of forgot a bit about crypto because it hadn't had really that adoption that I thought it would have because of, you know, how common sense I thought the tech was. And then in 2017, we had the, you know, people might remember we had that big hype cycle around Bitcoin and blockchain. It was all over the news. People were talking about it. And at that stage, you know, our friends and family were all interested to get cryptocurrency. I was working at Westpac and was giving a lot of presentations around the bank of what is Bitcoin, you know, how does it work, what's it all about. And it became apparent that in New Zealand, there wasn't a safe, simple, easy and cheap way for people to buy crypto assets. So my brother, Alan, set out to solve this problem and I came on board. The actual story here is an interesting one in that my brother decided that he could automate this process of buying cryptocurrency. So he sat down and the first thing he did was teach himself how to code. So he's never coded before. He sat down, he got an online course on coding, learned how to code, built this website. Then he put it live and strangers on the internet were sending him money for him to trade into Bitcoin for them. At which point he called me up and he's like, Janine, is there any reason why I shouldn't be doing this? And I was like, oh, this is not the ideal way to start a business in an area that has certain, you know, compliance requirements and that sort of thing. So I came on board and this is where, you know, all of the various skills that I picked up in different careers around PwC and government and banking really helped mesh together to enable me to wrap the business and operational support around the product that my brother had built. So we really started from very much a product market fit. We were solving a problem for ourselves, for our family and friends. And then we quickly established that, yes, we'd created something that other people wanted to use and other people saw value in as well, which is, you know, ultimately the goal of a startup is to create something that people want to use.
It is. And I love that story about your brother as well. Sometimes, you know, the best ideas, you try something, you put this absolutely kind of minimum viable product out there and you go, oh, there's a market, you know, let's go from there. And for you, you'd spent the kind of quite a few years in more of a corporate environment and large New Zealand companies. How was it making the transition from that into a startup?
I loved it. It did actually take me quite a long time. I was, I think, almost 3 years working part-time for my own business. So, you know, having it as a bit of a side hustle whilst working in corporate still. And a lot of the rationale for that was really just the financial one that we needed a stable income coming in. My brother was full-time in the business. I was part-time and we used my salary to ensure that we could keep the business running and keep bootstrapping ourselves without having to get external funding. But now that I'm full-time in the business, I don't think I could ever go back into a corporate. There is just something so rewarding and compelling and enjoyable about, you know, working in the kind of environment where you have so much of an impact, like you can get things done. And I think the corporates that I was working in, because they were such large companies, I mean, I think in New Zealand has something like, I don't know, 10 or 20,000 staff, and Westpac's not too much smaller than that. It is very difficult to take an idea and see that through into fruition. Whereas at a startup, everything is on you. You know, if you have an idea and if you don't turn it into reality, no one else is going to. So it's really this complete inverse of how much ownership and accountability you have in a startup compared to a corporate.
At the same time, as you said, that kind of the bonus of not necessarily having to wade through hierarchy or bureaucratic treacle to kind of get things done. You just go, okay, should we do that? Yep, okay, let's do it.
Sometimes to the detriment, right? Like that example I gave of, you know, how the business first started with Alan, just, I want to do something and let's just get it done. There are times when there is a balance, right? You do need to have a bit of administration and process and bureaucracy, particularly when you become a company, to help protect you and make sure you're operating within the bounds of the law. But that trade-off can be made relatively, still giving people a lot of autonomy and a lot of ability to get things done and not bearing in too much process.
And then how did the decision come about to go global? Was that always part of the plan?
So my background being in strategy, I've always been really keen on making sure that we had strong processes around knowing what our strategy is, knowing our targets, knowing our goals and working towards those. I think that's something that's really important for any company and particularly any startup. It really does help you set that direction and stick to it. And so it was in one of these sessions, I think it was the second one we had at the start of our second year of operations, when having our annual strategy session, we looked at what we had built and realized that effectively we had the makings of a global SaaS company. We could, you know, we had a way to buy and sell Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies really simply and easily. We could lift and shift that technology into any country as long as we could plug in local compliance requirements and local payment rails. So that was really the genesis of the idea of going global. We hopped over the ditch to Australia first as a bit of a test case of whether our theory of we can just pick this technology up and shift it would work. And I think, you know, many New Zealand companies do go to Australia because it's close and it's familiar and we all have friends and family over there. And then from there, once we'd sort of established that, yes, technically we could do this, we then started looking more seriously at which markets were the right markets for us to move into. And in this regards, I think we've had probably a bit of a different journey from the typical New Zealand export journey. We didn't go after the typical markets of UK, Europe, Canada, America. We've gone after the Southern Hemisphere markets, developing economies, and in particular ones where there's a high population of people who are unbanked. So we're looking at, you know, we're in Brazil and South Africa now. We're launching next in Indonesia and the Philippines and focusing more on Southeast Asia, South America, and Africa as the markets that we want to expand into. The reason for that is that we see the products and services we have as bringing a real opportunity for people to improve their financial lives, to make their lives better. And in those markets, in the developing economies, we see that people have been left out, not just by the crypto competitors, but more importantly, by traditional financial products and services. A lot of people don't have access to banking. They don't have the same opportunities that we do here in New Zealand. And so we really believe in the opportunity of cryptocurrency and digital assets to bring a lot of improvement to those people's lives.
Really interesting. And as so often is with certain perhaps more developing economies, we're almost, they make a whole technological leap. Mm. I know, for example, many, so I spent a little while over in Ghana in Africa, and that, you know, there were no normal phone telephone lines. Everybody had just skipped that stage and just gone straight to mobile. And it's so interesting to see, therefore, then the different opportunities and ways of working that creates.
Absolutely. And that's what I really think we're seeing at the moment is this leapfrog over traditional finance and straight into digital finance. And this is probably something that most people in New Zealand don't give too much thought to. But when you think about how we do money, it all goes through intermediaries. And those intermediaries, so banks, for example, they're not actually digital and they're not, our lives are 24/7 online, very digital. But when you look at, say, making a payment to someone, you can't make a payment on a weekend or after 9 p.m. on a weekday, that kind of thing, where the banking system, the traditional finance system, hasn't kept pace with how our lives and our economies are changing. And so there's a real obvious, you know, it makes a lot of sense that in economies where they don't have high bank penetration, they'll just jump straight over that because it is a bit archaic in many forms. And if you have a mobile phone, that's all you need to be able to access digital assets and cryptocurrencies. So there's a lot of opportunity there.
Really interesting. And I can't imagine, a lot of people talk about the risks or the challenges of going global, of exporting, and particularly something like cryptocurrency, where there'll be certain regulations perhaps in place in certain different markets, as well as different consumer needs, levels of education, understanding. You know, what have been some of the challenges of going global for you?
I think with cryptocurrency in particular, because it's such a new industry, there's a lot of places where the regulation hasn't yet been updated for what we're doing. So one example of that is in South Africa, there is no regulation regarding the buying and selling of crypto assets. New Zealand, we're fortunate in that New Zealand regulation is relatively broad-based. So because what we're doing looks like a financially type product, we get captured by things like the anti-money laundering legislation, which is absolutely appropriate and, you know, definitely should be observed by a company like us. In South Africa, though, the government yet hasn't passed any specific regulation, and because the regulation is silent on crypto assets, we're not captured. The approach that we've taken as a business to things like that, and this is probably an interesting one for sort of other export companies to think about, is whether you align with the current regulation in different countries or whether you apply an international best practice approach. So that's what we've done, which is in countries like South Africa where there isn't specific regulation, we still put in place all of the components of what that regulation would look like if it were there. And we have a good understanding of what the typical, for example, anti-money laundering legislation normally involves: customer due diligence and transaction monitoring and that sort of thing. So we can put in place all of those steps without actually being required to by the regulator.
Really interesting. And what opportunities do you think going global has given to Easy Crypto?
It's really given us, I mean, one of the big things that it's given us is the ability to go onto the global stage and to fundraise for our business. So we had been fully bootstrapped initially when we started. My brother and I funded all of the business operations. We, you know, mainly sweat equity. We did all of the work. We did all of the doing and we built the business ourselves. now we're at a stage that we want to raise funds and be able to grow even bigger. And having that international footprint was a critical part of that. We wouldn't have been able to raise funds from international investors as a New Zealand business looking to go global without first having those initial steps out into new markets. So that's been really important for us. The challenge now is to continue to grow those international markets, get those proof points that we can continue to raise and continue to grow as a global business.
Really interesting. And, you know, I'm conscious there's lots of research and stats out there about some of the challenges that women sometimes face in raising capital. What's been your experience? Have there been any particular challenges as a woman that you experienced through that capital raise?
Absolutely, and unfortunately. So this is, I guess, one of the areas where it's become most apparent to me around the unique differences and discrimination faced as a female founder. And it's really opened my eyes to potentially a lot of the discrimination is under the surface and isn't seen, because the little bits that have popped up above the surface are actually quite significant, which makes you wonder, you know, how much of that iceberg is not visible. But a few examples of that are just comments that I've had from people along the lines of, you know, I never thought I would have invested in a company run by a woman was something someone said to me. Another person commented how good it was for the company to send a woman to represent them, potentially completely missing the fact that it is my company and I'm the CEO of it. And I have also had people ask me, as part of fundraising due diligence, whether I'm planning to have children, which, you know, and my response to that in the moment was to counter with, would you have asked that question of a man? And the response was, well, no, because, you know, a man isn't going to have to take time out of the business to look after his child. And so I guess there's that sort of inherent assumption around whether or not women are capable of running businesses, how we would cope with the different myriad responsibilities that we all have in life. And I think there is a lot of that discrimination, that those were just the particular times when people decided to voice their views rather than just thinking them. And that's what I guess concerns me, is the amount of unsaid discrimination that's out there that would potentially result in me not receiving funding or another woman not having the opportunities that could be presented to a man. And we just don't have visibility on that.
I think it's a great point. I like the way you talk about it as an iceberg, because you, as you said, you'd only see a tip of it in terms of what somebody might say to you versus what they might say to somebody else, or what they might just be thinking that might influence their decisions. Yeah, great point. And I think it's so interesting, just those little ones, the assumptions, the biases that come. And I hope, you know, certainly on that parenthood piece, well, we've still got a long way to go. I hope having someone like Jacinda Ardern as our Prime Minister, who can show you can have a baby and still run the country, and with more men wanting to take up things like shared parental leave and play a bigger role, I hope that some of those biases will change, but a lot of them are fairly entrenched. And as you think about that going global process, or even that capital raising process, you know, what support have you been able to draw on that's helped you along the way?
This is probably an area where I haven't drawn as much as I could have. And I found a lot of things after I'd raised capital, in particular things like the support that NZTE has. So we're actually doing a convertible loan at the moment. So that's a bit of a bridging round to sort of tide us over until a Series B. And we're leveraging more of the opportunities that NZTE has there. Also trying to lean more into my networks, lean more into mentors and other founders, and just trying to really, I guess, take more of the opportunities that are available through people in my network, and with the understanding that I would help anyone in my network who came to me. So it's probably okay for me to step out of my comfort zone and ask for help a bit more, which isn't something that I think comes to many of us naturally, but I think it is really important, particularly as you're leading a growing business, to be able to ask for help and leverage your networks and leverage what else is out there in terms of resources.
I think it's often we not so you try to go it alone, but maybe don't want to bother or trouble people sometimes along the way. But as you said, you know, that usually when you ask for help, people are very happy to give it, but also that you'd be very happy to give it if anyone asked you for help as well. So creating that really kind of ecosystem of support around people who are going on a similar journey becomes really important.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I'm sure you've probably learnt loads of things through even just the few years of kind of growing your business overseas. What have been some of the key things that maybe you've learnt or discovered along the way?
There has been so many. And I think, you know, probably the overarching one is just that nothing is ever easy. And it's always, you know, people talk about how challenging and hard it is to run a business and to export. And it is that and more. It's always going to be harder than you think it will be. Well, I think one of the hardest things is sometimes the assumptions that we make because of what is normal for us that just don't hold true overseas and which you wouldn't even think to challenge. One example of that is we're operating in Brazil, and in Brazil, there is no way for someone to put a reference on a bank payment. And in New Zealand, when a customer puts money in our bank account, we get them to put a reference number with it, so then we know whose order to match it to, and that's how our financial system works. And it didn't even occur to us when we were setting up in Brazil to check whether that was a possibility, because that assumption of banking systems include, you know, deposit an amount, have a date, who it came from, and a reference, and just things like that, where you really have to try to strip things back to what is every single possible assumption I'm making here to be able to validate and check it. And that's really hard to do, because the thing with assumptions is that you don't typically know that you're making them. So that kind of idea of that it's going to be hard, that you need to sort of challenge and revisit things. And one of the best ways, or one of the most effective ways, I guess, to for companies and export is to have local people and to know, have people you can talk to. You can sort of set out your thinking and they can challenge that back with their levels of assumptions, which might show up some of those holes in what you're expecting to be able to do.
A great point there about kind of local knowledge and really understanding how do things work here. And as you said, you don't know what assumptions you have until you, because they're assumptions without testing them with somebody else. Great point. And what do you love about your current work today, Janine?
I really, really love the job that I'm in. And I think, you know, we were talking before about how you build up your career over this sort of mesh of different skills and experiences. And one of the things that I love most about where I am now is how all of these little odd things that I've collected over my career are all now coming together and really useful in what I'm doing. And I can see that I can add a lot of value to my company from all of the skills and experiences I've built up over the years. I also really love the challenge. Like, you know, every day is different. No 2 days are the same. There's a lot of hard work, which, you know, we talked about is it's always harder than you think it will be. But that's actually one of the best things as well, because that has resulted for me in so much personal growth. I look at who I am today compared to who I was 3 years ago when I started Easy Crypto, and it's just day and night. I've grown and changed so much in this role. And the last and probably most important thing that I love about my role is the people. So being able to lead an amazing team, people who are really passionate, really driven, being able to work together to create a vision and a strategy that we all believe in, and then be building a fantastic culture to execute on that together. There's nothing like that.
And you talked about it then about the people, and I assume with the fast growth of your company has come also going from small to quite a number of people in quite a short period of time. You know, how have you gone about creating that culture or still being able to kind of clearly articulate the strategy when you've got a whole lot more people as part of the company?
Yeah, it's definitely a real challenge, and particularly for us because we are a remote-first business and we have around 100 staff in 11 different countries, multiple time zones, different cultures. So that's a really interesting challenge to bring all of that fantastic diversity together and gel it in a way that everyone feels connected and part of the same team and passionate about what we're working on. I think we've had a lot of good success on this. Sometimes, some of it just through luck, some of it just through effort and intent. But it has been interesting to see how that culture is built and grown. I think the key thing for me is to be really intentional about it. I noticed relatively early on when we were about 20 people just how great our culture was and how much everyone really loved coming to work, how well we all worked together and supported each other. And I realized that we had something very special. So I set about establishing what that culture was, like trying to put it into words so that we could own it and promote it and make sure we grow it. And so that resulted in us developing our values. And we've got 5 values at Easy Crypto that we really try to live and breathe every day. They're a part of how we run our meetings, how we talk to each other, how we engage on Slack, which is where our company lives, how we recruit. And I think that's really important to know what makes your culture great, to define it, to give it words that everyone can talk about it and promote it and encourage it. And that's been a big part for us of keeping that culture fantastic.
Nice. What a good, as you said, almost to try and bottle it when you're small enough to really kind of get the sense of what it is. But I like the way you're talking about kind of living and breathing values, because there's no point in having them where they just sit on a wall and, you know, you occasionally every year come and have a wee look at them. Actually, they have to be part of you every day, don't they?
And that's one of the best bits of feedback that I have from, we run a quarterly engagement survey with our staff, and I quite often have people say in that survey, this is the first company I've worked in where the values are actually something real. They're not just posters on a wall, and that's how I know that we're nailing it. So yeah, just we have to make sure we're very intentional about keeping it up.
Yes, absolutely. And looking back, you know, as you said, you've taken those different aspects from different parts of your career. It's been such a varied career to date. But looking back in your career in its whole, what would you say have been some of perhaps the toughest career challenges that you've maybe faced?
I think probably working at PwC was a really tough period of my career, but also the one of the highest personal growth. And I think, you know, that's very similar to what I said about being CEO at Easy Crypto. And I think those two things do often go hand in hand, where really challenging periods, periods which you're really stretched, is where you really grow a lot. So that was a difficult period because it was always, you know, very tight deadlines, high expectations of work quality, but it was also just amazing to have exposure across so many different industries, different work environments, and, you know, really a lot of growth for me in my own professional career. One of the big challenges for me was when we started Easy Crypto and I ran it on the side of my business. And, you know, I referred to this before, I sort of had the full-time job and then the side hustle, which was pretty much all-encompassing nights and weekends. And that was a really big challenge. Like, I was working, I don't know how many hours a week, but basically my social life, my relationships, everything really took a massive hit because of how much effort was involved in starting the business. If I had the chance to do it again, I don't know that I would do it any differently, because you don't know that something's going to be a success until it is. And in my case, I had mortgages to pay, things like that. I didn't have the freedom to just go and go full time in the business from day one. But that was a really big challenge. It was, again, a very stretching time, a lot of personal growth, and probably the least enjoyable part of the business, actually.
And I think it is often created, as you said, out of the kind of the financial reason is to stick with a day job and to do something on the side. But that, of course, then from a time perspective, makes it hugely challenging because, as you said, you're trying to give your all to a growing business at the same time as still work a full-time job. So not easy at all. And Janine, we talked a bit about maybe some of the challenges that you faced as a woman when it came to the, through that, particularly that you saw through that process of going out for investment. Have there been any other challenges or obstacles that you've maybe faced as a woman along your career?
It's hard to know, because I think a lot of the time, you know, you have a bit of this kind of subtle gaslighting around things like this. Like, if you miss out on a job or if you don't get a contract, you're sort of like, does my gender have anything to do with this, or is it just because of XYZ? So it's always hard to know, but there are definitely some upsides, particularly in terms of the visibility and the confidence that it gives to other women. So I've had a number of people in my company and also customers, or just sort of people more broadly, talk about seeing me as a visible leader in the space, and that gave them confidence to get involved in what, you know, can often be seen as a relatively male dominated industry. So I really like that positive upside, that being visible can give other women the idea that, hey, this is a space for me, or this is something that I can look into. I don't feel excluded anymore. So that's a real upside.
And I think I read in a couple of articles about you the fact when it comes to recruiting people, it means that often you recruit for a wider diversity because, as you said, particularly the crypto world may be more younger male in terms of its typical or more traditional profile, but that actually women were looking and going, oh, a firm run by a woman, that's somewhere I would like to work. So it's enabled you to bring more women, particularly into the tech space.
Yeah, and actually I was just reviewing some CVs this morning, and one of the cover letters talked about how a female applicant for a job saw me and that got them interested in crypto, etc. So it is really neat. And yeah, in the tech space in particular, like, it's really important to me that we encourage as much diversity as possible. And we've got, I think, 40% female in our tech team, which is really fantastic. And, you know, across the business as a whole, we try to make sure that we at least have 50-50 going into interviews. And then that sort of flows through into, you know, having that diverse pool to recruit from.
And I like that's another example, I guess, of being really intentional about it. So still hiring ultimately the best person for the job, but if you have a balanced pool of applicants and candidates, that at least means that you're kind of intentional about that diversity to start off with, which is great. And, you know, we talked about some of the tough bits and along the way. If you look back at your career, what have been some of your proudest moments?
Easy Crypto is definitely my proudest moment, I think, just having taken something from, you know, from zero to where it is today. I mean, we still have a long way to go and a huge path ahead of us, but it's been exceptional just to see what we have built, and just through sheer willpower, really. Also, I think the impact on me personally, that's probably another really proud moment, is just seeing how I've grown as a person. And for anyone listening, it's something that I just really encourage people, I guess, to have faith in, because I don't think I would have ever expected that I would have the confidence and the experience and the skills I have today. But it's really been a journey, and at each step of the journey you get the ability that you need to take the next steps, and then before you know it you look back and you see how far you've come, and it's really quite extraordinary.
And I think, as you sort of said at the start, and imagine looking back at yourself as, say, a 17-year-old and going, in the future I'm going to be the CEO of a global cryptocurrency firm, you know, just that you never quite know where your career is going to lead you. But looking back on it, just that, you know, I can hear that pride in the journey as well along the way. And where, you know, Easy Crypto is still pretty new and obviously on a really fast growth trajectory, where do you see your own career heading in the future?
I don't know, to be honest. And I think, you know, I haven't really ever had a very intentional career path as it is. I mentioned before, I've just gravitated towards things that I enjoy, that I have a bit of challenge and that I can learn something new in. And I think probably I'll just continue doing that. And at this stage, that is still Easy Crypto. There's still so much challenge and growth and enjoyment for me here. And in the future, I think I'll just, you know, continue following things that help me build, you know, those aspects in my professional life and see where that takes me. I would definitely like to move into something more philanthropic. I think Easy Crypto does have a lot of potential, and this is one of the things that really drives me in it, is that opportunity to give people better lives and give people more financial opportunity. So I'd like to see, you know, Easy Crypto deliver more on that, particularly as we go more into the emerging markets, and or possibly that's something that I'd pursue on my own outside of work.
And you can hear that almost as you said, that there is that broader purpose. It's not just about a business set up to make money, that there's a broader purpose about, you know, financial access or equality that kind of sits underneath. One last question I'd love to ask you is, what career advice or business advice would you have for other women?
Absolutely, to back yourself. And I think for me, I did not have a lot of confidence earlier in my career. You build confidence as you go, but I think definitely just take that step a little bit further outside of your comfort zone, outside of your confidence zone, even just dip a little toe out and see what happens. Because the more that I've stepped into and stepped up into the roles that I've had thrust upon me, the more I've realized that I have the ability to do it and do it really well. And I think that everyone has that ability, and often it's just our confidence that is holding us back.
Wonderful advice. Thank you. Janine, it's been such a pleasure to speak to you today and hear about your own career journey, those different pieces of experience that you've woven along the way to now create Easy Crypto. For me, really fascinating to hear about that journey of kind of growth, fast growth, growth personally, but also growth of the company and growth overseas. Really fascinating. So thank you so much for sharing your story.
No problem. Thank you so much for having me on. Ka kite.
Thank you so much for listening to the Female Career Podcast, and I really hope that this story has inspired you in your own career journey. A big thank you again to NZTE for their support to bring to life this story of a woman going global. If you'd like to find out more about NZTE and the support they offer to help Kiwi companies grow internationally, then search online for NZTE Women in Export. And if you'd like to find out more about the leadership and career coaching that we offer at The Female Career, or if you'd like to book in a free introductory coaching session, send us an email, hello@thefemalecareer.com. Ka kite.